sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 13th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the Mass Torts Made Perfect Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. I'm on the road, and we have a jam-packed show for you today. I'm bringing on some folks from the Mass Torts Conference. And we're also going to have a bunch of people calling in about Occupy Wall Street on the program today. Susan Saladoff, the movie Hot Coffee. Talk to us about the general implications of tort law and access to the court system. We're also going to be talking to Daniel Denver, freelance journalist out of Philadelphia. He's going to give us a report on Occupy Philadelphia. We're going to get a call in from longtime listener William on Occupy Minneapolis. It's going to be fantastic. And later in the program, I will be taking your calls. And we'll have to deal with just probably a little technical issues. We'll see. Hopefully I'm sounding well. All right, folks. So we are here. I am in Las Vegas. Yes. Hold on. Let me just check on the sound. Bear with me, folks, for just one moment. I just want to make sure that we are, in fact, broadcasting. Always a challenge to do a remote show. It's never easy, folks. Incidentally, I am down. I am, in fact, down probably about $50. But, you know, what are you going to do? And so hopefully we're on right now. In just a moment, we're going to be talking to... bear with me, folks. One second. We're going to be talking to... on the show, I'm going to be talking to Sam Davis. He is an attorney that I've met here, and he is working on a project that really has... if it has that much implications in terms of the law and lawyering, but it was such an interesting project. I wanted to talk to him about it. We're going to be talking to others here. Cliff Schechter will be joining me over the next couple of days. Maybe we'll have Brad Friedman on. He is here. Some folks from Raw Story are in town. And like I said, Susan Saladoff as well. Okay, so Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Sam, you're an attorney from... Teaneck, is that right?
Teaneck, New Jersey, home of the Isley Brothers.
Well, there you go. That is almost... you're really reaching. I'm from Worcester, Massachusetts, and believe me, I understand the feeling. But I wanted to talk to you about this because Scott Milliken is here, the producer of Ring of Fire, had told me about... first off, I want to congratulate you because you are one of two people winning the Clarence Darrow Award here at the conference. Clarence Darrow, of course... Was mostly known, I guess, for his role in the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925, arguing this ridiculous notion about evolution. But so, congratulations to you for that.
Thanks so much.
And I want to talk to you about burnadvocates.org. This is a fascinating thing you got going here. Please.
give me some background on this.
Sure. Well, first of all, I just want to tell you I'm very humbled to have been chosen for this, and what a great moment in time, because, of course, Susan Saladoff's movie, in addition to pointing out so many important reasons to keep our access to justice strong, also made the American public very aware of the fact that scalding injuries are devastating. And it was learning about those scalding injuries that drew me personally to Haiti, because in the 47 seconds of that earthquake, there were over 1,000 children who were burned by scalding liquids. And when I went down there, I discovered to my horror that the only burn unit in the country had been destroyed, and there were these children who had been dispersed to all kinds of hospitals and clinics who were getting no real medical attention. So that sort of launched my involvement in building the first burn center in Haiti.
Well, let me ask you, what brought you down there in the first place?
Well, I was able to gather about 50 tons of medical supplies, and lots of people had gathered medical supplies, but I made one lucky phone call, and that lucky phone call was to someone I knew at Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines, and they were willing to turn their luxury cruise ships, which docked at this spectacular beach in North Haiti, they were willing to be our transport mechanism. So while everybody's medicines and bandages and medical equipment was getting held up in Port-au-Prince, we were able to deliver it via the northern route, and we got an incredible amount of goods there. But I was told, if you put it on a ship and you're not there to retrieve it when it lands, it will wind up in somebody's flea market. So I went down there as sort of crew on a Royal Caribbean ship, and when I arrived, I learned some of the harsher realities of Haiti, which are you've got to trust and verify twice, but that the Haitian people are such good, decent, honest, hardworking people, betrayed by their leaders. Sort of has a ring to it, doesn't it, Sam?
Yes, particularly these days. Fortunately, we don't suffer the same level of sort of devastation that they've been subjected to in Haiti.
Well, you've never been to Hudson County, New Jersey, perhaps. Well, I don't.
I do. I do not. I make it an absolute rule not to cross the bridge towards New Jersey.
Okay.
No, I was taught that at a very young age.
So it was really out of my comfort zone, because I, about 4 years ago, we started putting together music programs for children who were in these camps for specialized camps for kids that had serious burn scars, and trying to get them back into the mainstream. And then we built the first camp for burn kids in the Middle East. It was pretty unusual, remarkable camp. It's half Jewish, half Muslim. And then we decided that after seeing what was on down there, how can you not go after saving lives when it is so easy, relatively speaking, to do?
I mean, I'm fascinated. So it was through your practice that you became sort of aware of just sort of the implications of burns.
Right. My very first jury trial was a burn case 32 years ago. And I had realized that the devastation of burns is truly underappreciated by people. It was reinforced to me time and time again when I saw cases that we had successfully litigated and protected these children as they were growing up. Their money was put in trusts, but they never got back into the mainstream. They never got better. And one answer is that people who have serious burns get PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. We usually associate PTSD with our troops.
Right.
And indeed, one of the shocking things about burn care for American war veterans is that there are so many of them who are in great hospitals and facilities run by the government. There are a few great ones.
Right.
They're not being treated for their PTSD. Well, in children, and I'm talking about soldiers, by the way, who have been blown out of Humvees, fully engulfed in flames. When it comes to these children, we in the United States have developed a network of 40 camps that give aftercare to these kids and let them realize that they're not the most catastrophically pathetic children on the planet and that they can have normal lives. But outside of the United States, it barely exists.
You know, Sam, I mean, I'm struck, you know, one of the things that one of the reasons why I come to this conference is because I feel really strongly about the tort laws. I mean, it seems awkward to say, but I mean, it's about access to the courts. It's about some type of redress for citizens in the context of a society where government regulation has been corrupted excessively, and where we're dealing with corporate power. And we know that the corporations make a very cold calculation every time they put out a product or they cut a safety measure, and that is, will it cost us more to fix it or to make it safer, or to just deal with the potential legal implications in any way that our buddies can sort of shut down access to the courts? They'll do that. But what I'm fascinated about, and I don't think that people fully appreciate this, is that as a tort attorney, as a personal injury attorney, who have been really maligned, as far as I can tell, over the past 20, 30 years in our society, both, you know, sort of culturally and from a political standpoint, I don't think people appreciate how emotionally invested you get as an attorney working with people who have suffered, in this instance, you know, burns or other injuries. I mean, just give me a sense of that. Did you anticipate, I mean, is that why you went into this field, or is it just sort of something that, that you didn't realize?
I don't think I realized when I started my practice that there is an investment that you make in a case that goes beyond time, that goes beyond resources. If you can't connect with your client on some level, if you can't, to use that cliche, to feel their pain, or at least to appreciate that what they're experiencing, what you see of their burn scars and their disability, is the tip of that iceberg. If you can't understand what it's like for them to be bullied because they look different, then you can't really represent them. So, yes, you do get connected to your clients, and I always had a hard time at the end of a case saying, okay, well, goodbye, good luck, because you've worked with a client for 5 years, you've seen their family struggle, you've gotten them the money necessary to get like some surgeries that they need to get them to a camp. So I guess, particularly on my burn cases, I've kept track of my clients and I've seen what happens to them. And yes, there is a connection and there is that realization that they need more. And we're fortunate to be able to give them a little something extra.
Well, the website is burnadvocates.org. What can my listeners do to well, I guess they go to the site and they can find there's an opportunity for them to donate.
Absolutely.
There's an opportunity for them to get involved in other ways.
We're working on several projects. The one that I think is the most immediate and urgent is building the first burn unit in Haiti. Hundreds of children each year perish because they simply do not have a system, even a rudimentary burn care system. So we are starting that system, a communication network, bringing some telemedicine down there, and it's expensive. But I want everyone who's listening to this to understand that you hear so much about what's not working in Haiti and how, where's the money going? Well, you know, it does take someone to watch where the money's going, but we're building this unit at such a fine hospital with honest people and compassionate doctors. If anyone does want to get involved and make a donation, I personally guarantee them that that money will go into a burn unit, which will be opened in the next 18 months. If your listeners want to get involved in something equally as compelling, there are 40 burn camps in this country. They are amazing places of transformation and healing. And if they want to get involved by donating, by volunteering, come to our website, We'll fit you in. We'll find a place for you. It is so rewarding working with kids with burn scars and getting them out of that isolation, rejoining them and with their friends. And that feeling is perhaps as fine a feeling as you can have, even better than winning a big verdict. It's just a good feeling to help these kids.
Sam Davis, thank you so much for talking to us. It is burnadvocates.org. I really just tremendously impressed with your commitment to this issue. It's just it's just very impressive to me, and I appreciate you coming by and talking to us about it. And congratulations again on the Clarence Darrow Award.
Thanks for giving us this opportunity, Sam.
My pleasure. All right, folks, we're going to take a coming up next, she's just sitting down, folks, if you know, I've interviewed her, so if you could sit right over there, that way, yeah, that would be great. Fantastic. Joining me now is you don't need earplugs. Filmmaker, a director, the producer. Wow, you did a lot of things for this season. Of Hot Coffee. Now, folks, you can go back in our archives and put a link to the first interview I did with Susan when your film was playing on HBO. And we went through the entire movie, but just give me a primer of what your film is about.
Sure. Thanks, Sam. So everybody, of course, knows, or at least they think they know, the story of the woman who spilled coffee and sued McDonald's, the hot coffee case, so to speak, which is the title of our film. But most people have the facts completely wrong, because there was a huge public relations campaign when that verdict came out to convince the public that it was a frivolous lawsuit, when in fact, when you see the film and you see what happened to this woman and what the history was with McDonald's, it clearly, most people don't think it was frivolous at all. And so what I did was, is I tell the truth in the film about that story, and then I explain why people know it so much, because there was a huge public relations campaign that was set up by large corporations to convince the public that the system is broken, so that they would be willing to change it or reform it, which most people think is a good thing until they realize they're giving up their own rights.
Right.
And then when you do that, those who made products that harm us are not held accountable in the court of law. And so the film has four storylines. Each one represents a different way that we as Americans are giving up our rights to access the court system. And most of us have no idea until we need it.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, I don't know if there really is a single... And I don't want to, it's not an issue. I mean, if there is a single issue that is as underreported, I'm talking in the left, the left media food chain, to the extent that there is one, there is so little coverage and so little, it seems to me, sensitivity and understanding to just how important tort law and just generally the question of citizens' access to courts. And it is so crucial to our society. And like you say, you cover many different aspects of this. You talk about sort of arbitration clauses that people sign away their rights to hold their employers accountable or to hold AT&T accountable every time you sign up for a cell phone, essentially. And we had recently, I think we spoke before this went down, but I think since we spoke, there was essentially the Supreme Court decided that a California case where people would have access to sort of they doing a broader tort action. You know, for instance, on the arbitration of the AT&T, you know what I'm referring to?
The class action. You're talking Concepcion, which is where the U.S. Supreme Court essentially said that corporations can now ban class actions in their contracts, so that people are waiving their right to ever bring a class action, which most people don't really care about until you have a small claim. Let's say that AT&T overcharges you $35 a month. Well, if they're overcharging 2 million people $35 a month, not one of us individually will bring those cases, but collectively we
could. I'm not going to find a lawyer who's going to represent me for the $400 or $600 or even $1,000 that I've been overcharged over the course of 3 or 4 or 5 years. Because it's just too small amount of money. I mean, I can't hire a lawyer for that amount of time. It's just not going to happen. So people band together because they're a class of people, and essentially this prevents that entire thing at that
yes.
point.
Yes. So, you know, this is a systematic effort that's been happening over the last 25, 30 years, where corporations figured out that the only place that they would really be being held accountable is in our court system. You know, we only have three branches of government, and most people know that our executive branch and our legislative branch are essentially controlled by money. But our courts are supposed to be the place where average people can go head-to-head with the rich and powerful and get a fair shake.
Right.
And what's happened, unfortunately, is that corporations figured that out because they couldn't wine and dine juries. But if they could buy judges in our states where we elect our judges...
And you go into detail about a story of that as
in
well.
In fact, the book, The Appeal, that John Grisham wrote is a fictionalized version of one of the true stories in our uh-huh. film about a Mississippi State Supreme Court justice who was targeted for defeat by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because he wasn't pro-corporate enough. And, you know, I think we talked about this last time. Most yeah. people don't even know what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is. I mean...
Well, listeners of this program have a very good sense of who the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is. But you're right. In general, the general population has no sense. They think it's, oh, it's those nice guys down at the end of the Rotary Club, and they come and they help us beautify the neighborhood.
Or they think it's a member, part of the government, you know, the
right.
U.S. Chamber of
right.
Commerce. But, you know, what's happening right now with these whole Occupy movements around the country? Is that people are finally starting to figure out that, and not they're figuring out, but they're finally taking action and doing something to say, we're not going to take it anymore. Corporations, you can't just make all this money and essentially leave nothing behind for us. And our court system is another place that people should realize is being taken away from us.
Right.
And nobody really cares until it affects us personally.
Right.
And then when it affects us personally, we finally realize, wait a second, I thought I lived in a democracy, and this doesn't feel like a democracy.
And I think the thing that people don't realize is that every time the access to courts is limited for your average citizen, every time there is a cap put on torts, this changes the behavior of these corporations, and not for the positive. They can see, like, okay, our calculations have changed now. It would cost us X number of dollars to fix this defect, which will, you know, probably kill a dozen people or 20 people or whatever it is. They have actuarial tables. They know. They don't know who it will be. And they know how much that they would have to have paid out in scenario A. But now there's caps on torts. We're going to have to pay out less. We can afford 50 people to die.
Yeah, it's totally a cost-benefit analysis. And corporations' bottom line is to make money. I mean,
right.
it's in their bylaws. They're beholden to their shareholders for that. So they're not in the business of making sure that products are safe. They're in the business of making sure that they make as much money as possible.
And we should also make that they're not in the business. I mean, if we had a regulatory system that was functioning properly, it would be more of an issue. But they're not in the business of even following the law. They make that same cost-benefit analysis, and we see it. I think we see it on Wall Street. We see it in terms of products. We see it in terms of Massey Mines, the way that they determine their safety standards for their workers. We see it across the board. They do not believe we need to follow the law. They calculate what are the potential fines that we will pay, and are they less than or greater than how much we're saving or making because of what we're doing, and that's the calculation they use, isn't it?
That's absolutely true, but it's even scarier than that. They don't have to worry about following the law because the judges who are now sitting on the
right.
bench, who are elected and who run for office and have to raise money, are essentially being bought and paid for by these same entities, as we know. In
well, that's just one more element of the function, right? I mean, we also, if we end up going to, if we can move the jurisdiction to this to a court, we're in much better shape, and we're going to pay even less.
And what happens is that, you know, for maybe a relatively small amount of money for these corporations to invest in a campaign, it could mean $1 million or $2 million or maybe $50 million in the case of Massey, difference in whether or not they're held accountable in
right.
a lawsuit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if people have not seen your film yet, It is coming out on DVD in like...
November 1st.
November 1st, but people can pre-order it, is that
right
correct?
Right this minute. You can go to our website, which is hotcoffeethemovie.com, and just go right on any page. It says, order your DVD now, and it will be shipped on November 1st. We're also going to be doing this really fun holiday campaign for anyone who's running for office or who's in office. We're going to have people... You can come to our website. It's being developed right now, but in the next couple weeks, you can come to our website, and if you want to send a copy of Hot Coffee at a discounted price to any legislator, presidential candidate, anyone running for office, we will do it, and we'll, you can even send a holiday card and put a bow on it, and hopefully when Mitt Romney or Rick Perry or Obama comes back to their office in December, there will be many copies of Hot Coffee with holiday cards on their desk so that they will watch this film.
And you're going around city to city, state by state to... law schools.
I'm going to law schools, and also I'm going to hopefully start going to some of these Occupy Wall Street demonstrations to let people understand the importance of the civil justice system in this fight. And so, yes, I'm trying to get out city to city. And also, if your viewers have a movie theater in their area that they think will show a film, even though it's been on HBO, but it's a theater that might show a progressive film like this, let us know at hotcoffeethemovie@gmail.com, and we will try to get it into your movie theater. Also, when you get a copy of this film, have a house party.
Right.
Invite your friends and your neighbors and those people who make fun of these kinds of things and show them this film, because I think that everyone who has seen it at least says that it's an eye-opening film.
The McDonald's story is, there are moments where it's very hard to watch. You had a an elderly woman who went through an incredible amount of suffering that people are not aware of. I mean, and it's a little bit graphic.
The photographs are very, very graphic and alarming. And most people who see the film gasp.
I can't even talk about it without getting a little bit queasy. It's just such a wonderful film. I'm so glad. Just give me your sense, because you were an attorney. I mean, you still are, but I don't know if you're like a recovering attorney, but you were a practicing attorney for an extended period of time. There has been, like you say, over the past 30 years, some people point to the Lewis Powell memo, where sort of the idea behind it. But this is, it's a twofer for Republicans, isn't it? I mean, this is one of those areas where you see... To the extent that people look for real differences between Democrats and Republicans, this is one of those areas where it, and it's basically because trial lawyers end up being far more supportive of Democrats in terms of fundraising. That's just the nature of our system. But where there really is a distinct difference, because Republicans are a twofer, right?
But you know what's so interesting, Sam? It shouldn't be, because trial by jury is the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, all right? So if all of these Tea Partiers believe in the Second Amendment, why won't they believe in the Seventh Amendment?
Oh, Susan. Come on. You think that they just like to have guns, and it just happens to be an amendment in the Constitution.
But you know, every state,
I get your point, but
you know,
yes.
Every state has a similar constitutional provision, trial by jury.
Right.
And why is it that we totally trust juries when they're deciding in a death penalty case whether someone should live or die? We trust people who are jurors when they're voting, right, in every election. But for some reason, we don't trust them when they're holding accountable corporations who dump millions of gallons of oil into our streams.
And we should say that when people talk about tort reform and they talk about caps and this and that, when it's a business-to-business litigation, which makes up about 95% of all litigation, there's no talk of caps. There's no talk of limiting access. There's none of that. There's none of that at all, is there?
This is all a total... public relations, manipulation of the public. And it's been happening. So there's a line in the film that I actually love. It's George Bush, actually, who says, you know, you have to keep repeating things over and over again to catapult the propaganda. And it's so ironic, because that's exactly what corporate America has been doing. And with, you know, the media has been helping. I mean, the media, they've been lazy, Frank. I'm sorry, I know you're part of the media now, but, you know, essentially...
No, no offense taken.
You know, essentially, the media was lazy because they liked the sensationalized stories.
Right. Well, the media is constantly lazy, and, you know, one of the things that I tell some of the attorneys here is that, you know, you guys need to get more aggressive in getting some of these stories out, because just the general thematic story, I mean, really what they need to do is make your, you know, have people watch your film and then make three or four sequels, frankly. Because this is a message that needs to get out there. There has been 20 or 30 years of a one-sided argument, and it has changed people's perception of what our legal system is supposed to do, what it actually does, and the implications of what it does. I mean,
when people see my film, they say every American should see this film. Every high school student, every college student should see this film. It is eye-opening. Even people who thought they understood the issues, who read papers, who vote, who are educated. These are not issues that most people understand the way that it's explained in the film. And people say to me all the time, thank you for giving me an understanding of my constitutional rights that I didn't understand. And so, you know, we actually won this award at the Traverse City Film Festival, which is Michael Moore's film festival. Uh-huh. It's the award for the documentary that every American should see.
Oh.
And so, you know, I'm hoping that that happens, and I'm going to be working through 2012 to do everything I can to get this film into as many people's hands and eyes to see before they vote. And you know what, Sam? I tell people all the time, I'm not trying to change your minds. I just want to open your minds that there is another point of view. And because I was a trial lawyer, if I'm going to be asking you to render a verdict, I want you to know both sides of the issue,
right,
before you vote or before,
right,
you render a verdict. And that's what this film does. It tells the other side of this issue.
What the website for your film?
HotCoffeeTheMovie.com. And also, if you're a Facebook fan, if you could like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/HotCoffeeTheMovie. And there's a trailer online. There are action items. There's also a What You Can Do page and a Take Action page. So that after you see the film, if you're feeling pissed off, which you might and probably will, you can go to our website at HotCoffeeTheMovie.com/Take Action. And it gives you concrete ways that you can actually do something to change the system.
Great. HotCoffeeTheMovie.com. Susan Saladoff, thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to put a link to your site on Majority.fm, and I'll link back to our first conversation. I think we spoke for about an hour, and we got into the nitty-gritty about the film more. But it's a pleasure to talk to you here. And also, I want to congratulate you on winning the Clarence Darrow Award at the Mass Tort Conference.
Thank you so much.
Pretty impressive. And I have to say, it's pretty impressive. We've had two Clarence Darrow Award winners on this program today. Susan, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Sam.
And I should remind people, you know, that it was on Dylan Radigan's program that I first I sat down, I did panel, and Susan Saladoff came in as the expert.
She's going to be on Colbert on October 25th.
And she's going to be on Colbert on October 25th. Let's take a break for a moment, and I'll be right back. Oh, that's not what I wanted to do.
are back on the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live from the Mass Torts Conference in Las Vegas. I am down $50. I'm down $50. I don't know what else to tell you. Meanwhile, in just a few moments, we're going to be talking to Robert Price. He's just going to give us one example. It's a horrible story of another medical product gone awry. And the story behind it, because I just wanted to give you a flavor of the different type of things that the attorneys here are doing and just the importance of tort law in our society. And in just a few moments also, I'll be in touch with Daniel Denver. He is the freelance Philadelphia City Paper reporter. And he is going to... he's going to talk to us about Occupy Philadelphia. In the meantime, been quite a week with the Occupies across the country. They're growing, and you're seeing more aggressive action. Just the other day, Occupy Wall Street, members of Occupy Wall Street and other organizing groups. I mean, this is what you're starting to see, is you're starting to see some more of the institutionalized and community organizing groups are coming down to Occupy Wall Street and are basically recruiting people there and organizing people there to go and take other actions. One of these was on Tuesday, Occupy Wall Street protesters gathered together with members of some New York progressive and community organizing groups and marched uptown, essentially, in 2x2 because they had no permit. They didn't want to get busted, And so to go up on the sidewalk, so you got to walk 2x2. And they, went up to pay a visit. There was about 500-700 people there. It was organized by, a coalition of groups that are going by the name 99 New York. What's also stunning about this, I have to say, is I see the institutionalized left trying to develop messaging, trying to develop marketing tools, and they never come up with anything that functions properly as far as I'm concerned. But these Occupy Wall Street people within days have now made just this readily self-identifiable notion of where the 99%, and you're seeing it grow from out there. It's just fantastic. And so this 99 New York is made up of the Working Families Party, United New York, Strong Economy for All, New York Communities for Change, Move On, other groups. So they marched up to the homes of John Paulson, who is the famous hedge fund manager, JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, David Koch's house, Immigrant Savings Bank Chairman Howard Milstein, and Rupert Murdoch's house. And just basically dropped off things like a large, essentially to draw attention to the protest. I mean, just fantastic stuff. And, I have different feelings about the Robin Hood costumes. Because on one hand, I know that they get attention from the press. On the other hand, they're wearing Robin Hood costumes. But on the other hand, they're also, I think, meant to diffuse. I mean, it would be a lot more scary, I think, if these people were just riding down the river in kayaks without costumes and just saying, like, we're just practicing to take hold of, well, we don't know. We would never say. That, I think, would be interesting to see. All right, folks. And just in a moment, let me bring him in now because he just, joining me now is Robert Price. He is an attorney that's working on... it's a little disturbing to talk about. Robert, what firm are you with, and where are you at?
I'm with the Levin Papantonio Law Firm. We're based in Pensacola, Florida.
Oh, okay. So you work in the Paps firm. Okay, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. So tell me about this. This is a rather disturbing case, isn't it?
It is. It's a very disturbing case. It's an illustration of an FDA action gone awry, and it's an example of when you give the industry, the medical device industry, an inch, where they'll essentially take a mile, and that's what we see happening here with these devices that are being placed in women that really never should have been.
Okay, so these are transvaginal mesh device. What are these devices supposed to do?
These devices are used to rectify a problem called pelvic organ prolapse that occurs in women. When a woman has a child, there's a lot of there's some prolapsing that occurs. Some tissue and things can loosen and begin to sag. And what occurs is the prolapse of the pelvic organs will kind of sag down in a downward descent. And what these mesh devices are supposedly out there to do is to fix this problem. What a surgeon has at their arsenal when they're faced with a woman who has this problem is they can do a more traditional surgical technique, and that technique is applicable and it works for a lot of women. But what has happened is the industry has stepped in and they've sold the idea to these surgeons that, you know, instead of using these more traditional approaches, try our product. Use our product. You know, any old Joe surgeon can do it. You can take this 2-hour webinar and you can put this mesh in these women's bodies. And the worst part about it is that these meshes, they've never been tested before.
Wait, yeah, I want to get to that because that's really the sort of... That's sort of the stunning aspect of this. What are the implications? What? How have women suffered who have been subjected to this procedure?
What's happening is that these women are going in for these what's considered a relatively innocuous kind of 30-minute, non-invasive procedure whatsoever, and they're coming out with a polypropylene mesh that's been implanted inside of them, and you know a lot of women almost immediately, and for some women it can be a delayed reaction. You have pain, infections. The mesh will actually bond with the vaginal tissue because the mesh is so unnatural. The tissue and the mesh essentially erodes away and into the tissue, permanently scarring and disfiguring these women's vaginas. It's a horrible happening. These women's intimate lives are destroyed. It's a very bad product, and it shouldn't be out there, and it should not be being put in these
women. And there was no clinical trials of this product?
None whatsoever.
Now, why? How does something get approved to be inserted into a person's body without there being clinical trials?
Here's how it works. The FDA has a 510K process, and the premise of this process is that if you have a device, you can make more devices if they are substantially equivalent. But you know, in practice, that sounds good. It's like, okay, well, you know, we can have these devices out there. You can encourage productivity through expansion in it without having to go through these tests. And it may seem all right to the average person, but what's going on is, and this is the perfect example of what's happening, over 15 years of the evolution of a product, where these products started, they started off of simple pieces of mesh. You may have heard of mesh being used in hernia repairs and things like that. This mesh is also used in stress urinary incontinence repairs. And what these people have done, they've submitted 510K applications to the FDA and said, hey, we've got this kit. It's a kit. It's got these guided needles. It's preformed. You can put it in your patients. Oh, and it's just like, this other piece of mesh, or it's just like this other device. And these manufacturers have been able to get away with doing that. And it starts over here with one device, and 15 years later, without the FDA doing anything, they've just now done something about it. They've just now realized, after thousands and thousands of thousands of women have been affected, they've just now realized, oh, wait a minute, these products have evolved to something that is totally different.
Right.
And no testing whatsoever. The testing that's being done is being done on women.
So, I mean, how does a company decide, a producer of this? I mean, what is their thought process? Hey, we have this product. We're making it for certain applications. Let's just see if it can go for other applications. That's basically what they do, right? I mean, if we can sell this thing for 7 applications as opposed to 4 applications, we can double our money.
Absolutely. That's what you see happening here. You see in the area of stress urinary incontinence, these meshes came out in the form of bladder slings. This inundated the market in the late 90s and in the 2000s. And, you know, virtually any woman that's been affected by childbirth and who has suffered from this SUI symptom, there's a lot of women out there affected. So that's essentially what they've made billions of dollars off these products, and they're like, oh, well, let's just expand it to more stuff. If it's made of mesh, let's see if we can put it in these women's bodies.
And
let's
they do no testing
kits.
Whatsoever. What responsibility do they have to sell a product and know that it's not going to cause massive problems in the people they're selling it to?
I think they have all the responsibility. I think that women who are now finding this out, whose doctors have told them that this product is fine, the information that the doctors are receiving as well and that they're passing on to their patients are based on virtually nothing. They're based on just simple
and what
claims,
kind of doctor, but, frankly, you know, like, you know, I'm very fortunate because my doctor is one of the most conscientious human beings I've ever come across. I mean, that, you know, I go in for a blood test, he calls me 3 times to give me the results to make sure I heard them, make sure I understand them. I mean, he's incredibly thorough. But these doctors, They just basically, if the company tells me it's fine, I'm just going to assume it's fine, right?
I think you see it time and time again. These device reps are just like pharmaceutical reps. When you go in to see a doctor and here's some free samples, unfortunately, there's no free samples here. It's just, here's this device, let's put it in.
Do you think the doctors knew there was no clinical trials on this? Or, I mean, do you think the doctors rely on, in the same way that all of us do? I mean, people have to understand this. This is the functional equivalent. If I said to you, folks, hey, you got to listen to the Majority Report with your earphones on, and I just sent out like a high decibel pitch that essentially shattered your eardrums, and I'm like, well, you know, it's not my fault, folks. Yeah, you know, I mean, that's essentially what the situation is. Do you think that the doctors have that same sort of default notion of like, oh, they couldn't sell it to us. This couldn't be on the market. This couldn't be approved by the FDA if it weren't safe.
I think doctors are practitioners, and there's people too. Doctors are people too is my point in that, you know, you have the good doctors that do the research and they do these things.
Right.
But then you also have unfortunately, a stammeringly large amount of doctors who simply, they get a product in their hand or they get a pill in their hand that, you know,
and they just assume
it's fine. They just assume it's okay. They've been told it's okay, and they pass that information on to their patients, who, you know, patients put a lot of trust in their doctors, and they will go in. The women that I've talked to, a lot of them just said, you know, I went into my doctor. My doctor said, let's use this mesh thing, and they put complete trust into their doctors. And unfortunately, that trust, it assimilates all the way to an industry that is abusing population.
And so now, what is Lev and Pap Antonio do in this sense? Essentially, they got to get together like they're going to do a mass tort, which essentially means that they're going to define a class, right? I mean, they're going to represent a class, all these women who have been involved in this procedure, and they're going to sue the device maker on their behalf. Is that right?
That's correct. That's essentially what we do. We try to do things in the best balance. We try to represent as many people as that's been harmed by this product as possible. But, you know, in these cases, they have kind of a special twist to them because every woman involved in here is different. They've got different injuries. And just as we've talked about, they've got different doctors, too. You've got to explore all of the avenues. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we've got to take it as a mass tort, and we've got to bring it against these big device manufacturers who are going to fight these cases. So we're fighting the fight. We're bringing these cases against these manufacturers, but every single case is different, and we got to look into that too.
To what extent does your bringing this action also put any pressure on the FDA and to change the way that they approve these mechanisms? Because I understand what happened. You have device A that the FDA scrutinizes intensely when it first comes out. And then it becomes device A plus. And the FDA said, well, it's substantially the same. And then it becomes device A plus plus. And then A plus plus plus. And A plus 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 plus. And by the time you get to A six or seven iterations down the road, it is really different from A.
Absolutely.
Even though it's not so different from A plus 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 plus. And what pressure is put on the FDA to change that mechanism which they approve for stuff?
Unfortunately, as you probably know, the pressures that are being put on the FDA is coming from an industry with deep pockets. The FDA has got so many more revolving doors and so many more people and just with buckets of money who go in and they influence the FDA. This scenario is very interesting because the FDA, in all but these words, has come in and said, "We screwed up. This is bad. This is not good." They basically, back in 2008, they saw these adverse events reports, which were underreported in the first place, and then they came out and they said, okay, we see these bad things happening, but this is rare, stay tuned. And then just this past year, in September, they've conceded that their process is flawed. They've come back and said, oh crap, this is not rare. These prolapse mesh devices, now they need to be reclassified. We need to change them to a different classification where they can't go through the 510K. Now we need to do this after thousands and thousands of women who've been hurt lately.
400,000 women have been affected by this. Is that right?
Approximately. We're looking at it something that gets placed in about 75,000 women per year. And it's been going on since about 2004 was the inception of the first transvaginal mesh kit device, which began this process of pumping these things out.
Well, Robert Price, I appreciate your coming and telling my story.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Now I'm going to go to the phones. We're going to shift a little bit here. Why am I hearing that? Why? There we go. Folks, we're going to take phone calls now at 646-257-3920. And then also in just a moment, I'm going to go to... give Daniel Denver a call about what's going on in Philadelphia, the Occupy Philadelphia protest there. All right, hopefully this will work here. I want to go live now, and I think we got, is this William, is this you? William, are you there?
Yeah, hello.
Can you hear me on your phone, buddy? William? William, can you hear me?
Hello? Yes, I can hear you, Matt. Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Is this you, William?
Yes, this is me. Oh. Minneapolis.
Oh, great. Ladies and gentlemen, it is William is longtime Majority Report listener, now works for the Minneapolis affiliate. Can I say that? You're at Occupy Minneapolis, is that right?
Yep, I'm here braving the cold.
Is it cold?
Yeah, it's about 55 degrees right now. It's warming up from where it was about a half hour ago.
So tell me, what's going on there? How many people are sleeping out? What's happening there?
Well, I would say last night about 80 to 100 people were camping out. There's probably, I would say, close to 200 people right now. That are, as the day's moving on, they're kind of filtering in and waking up and getting a little more buzz around here. When I got here really early this morning, there wasn't a lot going on. People were freezing and sleeping.
Wow. And so how many, where exactly are people occupying in Minneapolis, and how long have they been there?
Did you say where exactly?
Yeah.
Okay, Hennepin County Government Center. It's basically right in the heart of downtown. It's all the court cases come through here. The commissioner's office is here. And there's a large, I think we renamed it the People's Plaza. And there's a large fountain, and everyone's camping around that.
And how long have people been camping out? When did this start?
About October 10th is about the day that people started coming out here.
And are you holding general assemblies now? Are they starting to form committees to deal with both their living arrangements and message developing?
Yeah, there's general assembly once or twice a day out here. There's a committee that's very organized. It sounds a lot like the Wall Street one. There's donations, there's a kid area, there's a big food area that's packed with food right now. There's a media center. Basically, everything I've heard at other places, it sounds like it's about the same here.
Interesting. And how's it been in terms of the police?
You know, compared to a lot of other reports, the police have been great here, in fact. Their biggest mission has been protecting the protesters on the marches to the banks, and they haven't been cracking down on the protesters at all. In fact, when the power gets cut, they have like a mobile surveillance camera, and they've let the media center plug into the generator that powers the camera, so they've had power for the media center. Yeah, they've been really great.
I mean, I wonder if...
No arrest yet.
That's great. And so there have been marches on, towards the banks, is that it?
Yeah, especially Tuesday, the morning march, which had about 250, 300 people, they marched on U.S. Bank, and they marched on Wells Fargo, and then in the afternoon they marched on a local bank here, TCF, which donates to a lot of right-wing candidates here in Minnesota.
Fascinating stuff. All right, William, anything else I should know about what's going on there in Occupy Minneapolis?
No, I don't think so. You know, it's a great place for there's a huge family area, and there's a lot of food, so we're encouraging everybody who can come down here.
All right, great. Well, thanks for calling in and giving us an update. Really appreciate it.
Later in the afternoon.
Yeah, no problem, Sam. Thanks.
Okay. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when I come back, hopefully I will have Daniel Denver on the phone. In just a moment. All right, folks, we are back, and on the phone, Daniel Denver. He is a freelance journalist. He writes for the Philadelphia City Paper, The Guardian, all over the place, and right now he's out on the streets of Philadelphia. What's going on, Daniel?
I'm out here in front of Philadelphia City Hall, the biggest municipal building in the United States, and there are well over 100 tents set up, and the crowd fluctuates into the thousands for the marches, and it started last Thursday.
Wait, did you say over 100 tents?
Oh, well over 100. I started trying to do a count, but it could be up to 200. The entire Dilworth Plaza in front of City Hall is just blanketed with tents.
Wow, that's fascinating. So you're getting thousands of people down there to march as well?
Yes, there was a big march to the Liberty Bell in Independence Hall on Saturday, and there is another march in the works for this weekend. It's not clear exactly when it's going to take place. They're having general assembly meetings, much like what's going on down on Wall Street, twice every day to make these decisions collectively.
And when did this...
And it's incredible to see them make it.
When did Occupy Philadelphia start?
There was a meeting last Tuesday, over 1,000 people packed into a Center City church. And within 2 hours, we decided to gather on Thursday at City Hall. So it started last Thursday morning, a week ago today, at 9 a.m.
And
it's been going... Really,
that's a lot of people for Philadelphia, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a huge amount of people. But, you know, Philadelphia is really a working class town with a strong union history, and it's a city with a lot of poverty. And what's most interesting about the last 2 days is more and more poor people, homo people, people who have really gotten the shortest end of the stick and gotten most hurt by this Wall Street induced economic crisis are showing up in increasing numbers. The mainstream media stereotype of this being a bunch of lazy college graduates couldn't be more contradicted by what I'm looking at right now.
Wow. And are there are you getting is there starting to be a more institutional support for this in Philadelphia? Are there local unions that have come out in support of what's going on down there? Are there plans for bigger marches with unions?
Yes. Last Saturday was the first big major labor turnout. There were a lot of healthcare workers from SEIU out. I know that there are representatives of a number of different unions who have been meeting regularly with Occupy Philly organizers. And so we still haven't seen that critical moment like happened last Wednesday in New York,
right,
where there was just a mass labor turnout that really turned the tides up there. But I'm I think organizers are rather hopeful that that'll happen. And AFL-CIO did endorse it from the get-go, the Philadelphia AFL-CIO. So those lines of communication are definitely open. And I think that it's like we're going to see increasing collaboration between Occupy Philly and, you know, a number of different local labor struggles taking place, whether janitors or communications workers who just went on strike against Verizon or are still fighting Verizon. I think there's going to be a lot of places to link up those fights.
And did representatives of Occupy New York come down to Occupy Philly and help folks set up like the General Assembly and those type of things?
Not that I'm aware of. An organizer from New York is coming down this afternoon, a friend of mine who's worked on the Occupied Wall Street Journal, but he's coming down just to see how things are going down here. There was no direct assistance as far as I know. I assume there was communication.
That's really fascinating. I mean, that's really fascinating to me because we're starting to see these crop up everywhere. I just spoke to somebody from Occupy Minneapolis, and, you know, to have literally hundreds of tents, or over 100 tents already set up with that type of core group sleeping out. And it seems like these things are happening, you know, beyond, it's almost like an uber organic, you know, because there's not even people who are helping with how you set these things up. I mean, never mind institutional support, there isn't even sort of like people with experience coming down. People just seem to sort of like watch what's going on live stream and get the idea and go down and set it up. Is that accurate?
I think social media has been crucial to teaching people how to set these things up without having to be in direct communication necessarily with people in New York. Everyone here was certainly watching what happened in New York very closely. So, you know, when they did their first human mic at the first meeting here, everyone already knew how to do it because they've been watching it for 2 weeks already. The level of self-organization is amazing. There are committees dealing with media. There's a labor committee. There's a comfort committee that goes around to every tent and assesses what people's needs are just to, you know, to be as comfortable as possible sleeping outside out here. There's There's a library set up in a tent here with dozens and dozens and dozens of books for Lent. There are teach-ins and all sorts of educational forums. At any given moment, you just look around and there are circles of people discussing who knows what.
Wow.
And there's so much spontaneous energy behind here, but behind this and behind New York and behind everywhere else in the country. But people were really waiting for something to happen, and this was the spark. Maybe it could have been something else, but this is the spark that lit it. The last few years have just been such a sort of nightmarish alternate universe with the Tea Party dominating the debate, blaming the people who've been most hurt by this crisis for causing it. I think there's just something so incredibly refreshing about seeing the people who caused the crisis blamed for it and clear demands that they be held responsible. I think that's really what's just drawing people out here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that. And I also think actually, one of the things that really sticks out for me is, there was a real concern that the young people who were brought into this, who were brought into politics by the Obama campaign, would become jaded and cynical. And it seems like it's almost made them more empowered. I hope they're not coming for you, Daniel. But it seems like it's made them more empowered, and in some respects, they're also, I think, part of what accounts for why it took so long for people to take these type of steps was a function of people getting through the process and realizing that, like, it's not going to come from Washington. that change that we thought we voted in is not going to come from Washington. It's something's going to have to happen on the ground.
Yeah, I think people, who have grown up doing the right things, expecting that if they worked hard, they would be able to get a decent job and start a family and all that. I think that American dream has proven to be increasingly illusory, and they first took their complaints through the proper channels, the official channels, which are electoral, and got excited about Obama and supported the Obama campaign, and then we're probably shocked to see Larry Summers and Tim Geithner appointed the administration, and shocked to see how inadequate the stimulus is, and shocked to see the harsh Tea Party austerity that we see being imposed from Congress to state houses nationwide, and this is definitely there's a lot of the Obama generation out here, I think, that realizes that those channels are not enough. They tried that in 2008, and look at where we are now.
Daniel, let me just ask you, you mentioned there's over 100 tents that are set up outside of City Hall. Any sense of, are there any restrictions? In other words, can these people literally stay there through the winter? And how has the city been working with the protesters? Has there been any problems with the cops? Has there been any problems with the city? Just give me those sort of logistical, give us a sense logistically of what's happening there.
Well, the city of Philadelphia and Mayor Michael Nutter have really provided a pretty sharp contrast to Bloomberg in New York. There haven't been any arrests yet. The city very politely asked the protesters after they'd already started the occupation if they would mind filling out a permit. After a day or two of General Assembly discussions, they agreed to do so. The tone has been pretty respectful, and I think both protesters and the city have contributed to making that the case. That said, it's recently come out in the last day or two that major renovations long since planned for Dilworth Plaza are supposed to begin on November 15th, and the city is going to ask protesters to relocate to another two plazas that are right, within eyesight here. I think that it'll be worked out without confrontation, given the good track record that both sides have had so far. But that is a potential point of conflict.
All right, well, Daniel Denver, a freelance journalist out of Philadelphia. You can see him in the The Philadelphia City Paper and his website, Daniel Denver. We'll link to it on majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. Let's go back to your calls and your Should I need to put in that music? No, it's free. It's like Freebie Friday, except it's Freebie Thursday today, folks. You get a full show. Still catching up, obviously, on things from this past week. And let's see who we've got on the phones. You're calling from a 541 area code. What's your name? Who's there?
This is Kurt Saudi.
I'm sorry, say again?
I'm calling up Kurt Saudi.
Okay, oh, Kurt.
I'm a member?
Yes, how are you?
Pretty good. I was just calling about the medical devices. I worked in surgery. I've been doing it for about 20 years.
Yeah.
And we still put in TVTs, that transvaginal taping, and we take them on routinely.
All right. I'm sorry. Say that
but
again.
Surgery.
You still use.
We routinely put in TVTs. What you were talking about, the transvaginal taping, and we routinely take them out too. So they do the road, but the surgeons don't care.
Okay, so I'm not following what you're saying. You use them regularly in surgery, and they're effective or they're not. You got to turn your computer down.
Well, they do work, and we do take them out.
Yeah, I think you're talking about something different from the mesh.
It is mesh.
Okay, so you're saying that there's no problems? So I don't understand what your point is. Your point is that
there are problems.
Oh, there are.
There are problems.
Oh, I see.
There are problems with them. We remove them on a routine basis.
And so why do people keep using them?
Because the surgeons get paid for doing surgery.
Right.
That's what it is. And they don't take it serious at all. I mean, I stand beside them every day and listen to them. And they think it's a joke, these complaints.
That's stunning.
And there's a lot more. I mean, we do lap bandings, which is a band that's filled with saline that goes around the stomach to curb your appetite. And those who are through the stomach, or they get infected, and we take them out on a routine basis. But if these guys don't do surgery, they don't get paid. It's fee-based. That's what people got to understand. When you go see a surgeon, you're going to get operated on.
Right.
If they can do it.
Right.
I mean, it's not a noble... I mean, it's... You know, you walk into their office and you got a complaint, chances are you're going to get operated on. And like the Zimmer knees, you know, none of the orthopods care about that.
Wow.
I haven't seen one stock using a Zimmer knee. Not one.
All right, Kirk, thanks for calling. I appreciate the phone call. I got to let you go.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Folks, let me tell you, I don't have a screener today, so if you're listening to the show and you're calling in at 646-257-3920, when I start talking to you, please stop streaming the show. Because if you're... Or turn it down if you're on a phone. Because when you still listen to the show, I can hear me echo back. But that was Kirk just basically saying he works alongside surgeons every day. And, you know, it's a fairly obvious proposition. We just assume that doctors are somehow different from other people. But if you go see a surgeon, he said, you will be operated on. Because their solution for everything is to operate on it. Because if you want to be cynical, because that's the only way they make money, and if you want to be a little bit more generous, it's because when you're a hammer, everything's a nail. And so, you know, you come to me with an issue, and I'm going to talk to you about it, because that's what I do professionally. Interesting perspective. Oh, we just lost a caller. Sorry about that. Let's go to the IMs. Shorty Spice 055. Oh, wow. I got a lot of... I hear the stream a little muffled. Otherwise, we can hear you. Hopefully, it's okay now. Bush and Chains. You can call me at 646-257-3920. Bush and Chains. Canada's right-wing dictator Stephen Harper still playing Mussolini to George Bush's Hitler. Here comes the Occupation Party. Outright fraud. J.P. Morgan's derivative bets against J.P. Morgan. Interesting. I guess drug laundering is unbelievable. AIG offering liar's insurance to their corporate buddies. More bad news for Rubenites. Disciples, RGEs for sale. Yes, I guess that's his investment advisory firm or something. I don't know. I don't know what it is. Italy's union credit halted down 7.88%. We got a phone call. You're calling from a 503 area code. Who's on the phone?
Excuse me. Hey, Sam Cito, this is Mario. I tweeted at you yesterday about Kabu, our local, kind of like local NPR affiliate, but their, the local stuff is really good, you know, so once they carry that national crap, you know how that goes. But I'm calling from Portland. I'm actually in the comforts of my home right now, but I spent basically the last week...
Mario, wait a second. Let me ask you a question. Mario, are you calling from Portland, Maine or Portland, yes, Oregon?
Portland, Oregon. I apologize.
No problem.
From my understanding, is one of the biggest Occupy solidarity movements outside of New York. Let me just give you some details. We're right in downtown. We had over 10,000 people at our march, which was last Thursday, a week from today, or a week ago from today, on the 5th or 6th, I forget, whatever it is. It's funny, we're downtown in between 3rd and 4th Avenue, and we occupy actually two parks that are right next to each other, and the Justice Center, and I say that, you know, with quotes, because it's where the prison, the local jail is right there, it's called the Justice Center, and right across from that is the courthouse. So we actually had a couple guys get arrested this morning because we had been occupying the street that was separating the two parks. And through General Assembly, we could not reach a consensus on exactly how we wanted to get the park back to this to the city and to the rest of the 99% that can't occupy the park there. We wanted to make sure it was nice and safe. But also we have concern about, you know, lots of cars coming through because we have children in the park at the occupation. But we also got a... We did give the street back without a few people that voted to keep occupying the...
So let me see if I got, Mary, let me see if I got this straight. You were occupying a park, but also the adjacent street, and couldn't come to a consensus as to whether or not you should give up the street. So some people did, and some people didn't, and those who didn't got arrested.
Exactly. And it was very few that actually, like, there's a lot of people that voted and were like, yeah, let's keep the street, but,
right,
you know, when rubber hit the road, they weren't there at 6 a.m. to stop, you know.
So how many people are sleeping out? How many people are occupying this space?
Well, upwards to, I gotta say, I mean, I'm not a big numbers guy, but there's gotta be 100, at least 200 people.
There's, wow.
Like, yeah.
So, Portland's pretty strong.
Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
Say that again?
Yeah, Portland's been pretty strong throughout. And like you said, you had 10,000 people marching last week. What do you anticipate is going to happen with folks down there? Are they talking about plans in the future? Are there going to be more? Are you going to see unions come out in support of these people? Are there going to be community organizing groups?
They've already come out. there's been a lot of great subcommittee work.
Uh-huh.
Committee work in terms of, we're already got a committee that's specifically based on long-term occupation. What are our long-term goals? And then also, what are local goals that we can get, initiatives that we can get on the next ballot coming up, next election? I mean, we got people on the ground, like, doing work, like, people that are part of the occupation, but, like me, I'm living at home because I'm paying rent, I have a roofing firm, my kids and stuff, and so I can't, do it all down there, but I'm there a lot, and then checking it out. But let me give you a little rundown of some other things we got here. So, in terms of, the committee work is great. It's just hard to get it has to be 99% for consensus.
Right.
Which is what we agreed to. So,
99% consensus?
90%.
Okay. I was going to say 99% consensus. That's super tough.
Yeah, that would be nearly impossible. Certain things, it's like, it wouldn't be that tough. It's like, should we provide Medicare, medical help to anybody who needs it? Of course, we're going to need it. Unless we have infiltrators, which clearly there are, I can tell you that right now. There's people that are trying to incite violence. But there's so many, for every person that's trying to incite some sort of, energy, there's like five people that are like, hey, man, it's all good. We need, some coffee or some water or, whatever. You want to do some art to express yourself. It's great. But, we have two art tents. We have a medical tent, a kids' camp, an engineer's tent that they build tables, and they actually built a couple of bike-powered generators. So, generators might run out of energy, and then they hook it up to the bike-pedaled tent, and then the guy will sit there and bike for a while.
All right, listen, Mario, I gotta let you go because the sound's not so great, but thanks for reporting to us on what's going on in Portland. I really appreciate you calling it.
Thank you very much, Sam. I love it. Have a good one.
All right, you too. All right, folks, forgive me for the quality of that. A lot of people call in. They have they have a microphone set up. I can tell they're calling from a Skype thing or something like that, or your headsets don't sound as well. So try and always, when you call in, get as clear a headset as possible. But interesting stuff coming from Mario there in Portland. So we now have heard from Philadelphia, from Minneapolis, from Portland, all of these occupies going strong. Boston still, having problems and conflicts with the police up there. If anybody's listening from the Boston area and has been down to those Occupy protests, please give us a call. Let us know what's happening. 646-257-3920. If you've been to any other Occupy protests around the country, call in. Let us know what's happening there. This is going on around the country. Now, I should say, I haven't even told the story. On Monday, we had a pre-taped show, but Nikki was out of town, and so we had no babysitter for Myla. So I spent the day with Myla. I had to, she had the day off because it was Columbus Day. We went down to the Occupy Wall Street protests. She's six. She was a little bit nervous. I got interviewed by the local news just simply because I had a kid with me. And this local news, sort of like a, classic local news reporter, asking me, does she know why she's down here? And I said, well, not particularly, because she's six. She doesn't even know why she goes to school, frankly. She doesn't know why she does anything. She's here because I took her down here. I wasn't quite this confrontational, but it was just one of those classic, she knows why she's here. Of course she does. She wrote her thesis in kindergarten on the dual mandate of the Fed. And she's just pissed that not enough has been done on the employment side. And so then she says, why did you bring her? And I said, because I think this could be a historical moment for accountability in this country and a historical time at the beginning of a movement where people are going to exercise their legitimate power and their influence over our government. And I wanted her to be here because she'll remember coming. And then she says, there have been rumors of drug use and hygiene problems here. Aren't you afraid for her to be in this park? Cliff Schechter just walked by and he heard me say drug use?
Dude, I took a shower.
Hygiene problems. And and I said, well, I mean, look around. Considering the fact that there are hundreds upon hundreds of people sleeping here, I don't see any hygiene problems. I live in New York City. They're talking to me about hygiene problems. And it was, you know, a really leading, horrible question that was editorializing in a question in and of itself. And some guy got was overhearing this. And he comes up and goes, good response, buddy. And then he just starts yelling at the reporter. And frankly, I appreciated his sentiment. He was right, but he got too aggressive with this reporter. It wasn't appropriate. And it scared Myla. And so we had to walk away from there. And but, you know, she still, we walked around the park. She was asking some questions. She was a little bit nervous. We ran into Jeff down there, who's now working at the media center. I think that's probably why I can't even call in now, because he's probably just too busy taking media requests from just about everywhere else. And so we ran into a bunch of people down there, and she enjoyed it. And then we went up to MSNBC to do the Rattigan show. And went down to, how's the sound? Is sound okay with me?
You sound good, man.
Okay. And we went to the Rattigan show. Naomi Klein was on. Myla, I forced Myla to watch Up with Chris Hayes with me every morning on the weekend. And so she had recognized Naomi Klein. So she went up to Naomi Klein and said, I saw you on the TV this weekend. And then she was sort of helping the makeup lady give makeup to everybody. And literally, I come in to check on her, and she just sort of like looks at me, and she waves me away, and she goes, this is my six-year-old daughter. She waves me away and goes, go back to the green room. Go back to the green room. Get out of here. Go back to the green room. So I think Myla has found her calling. Combination of either a makeup artist or just boss. Let's go to Harold. I don't remember you being so passionate about Tort Law in the past. Been hanging out with RFK Jr. and Pap outside of Ring of Fire. Keep it up regardless. Bought $12 of Reese's Peanut Butter Cups via your Amazon link. What are you doing with $12 worth of Reese's? Oh, I guess Halloween? Yeah, I mean, Harold, I mean, I've spoken to Pap on the show and Peter Mouget on the show, and I did this conference 6 months ago, I guess it was, and it's for the same reason, and it is, we've talked about this quite a bit. We talked about that California ruling, Concepcion, I guess it was called, that cut down on class actions. And frankly, in my mind, it has become far more relevant as a means of controlling corporate power with the assault that we have seen on our regulatory agencies. And an assault that has really been, I don't want to say unabated, because that would be unfair, but has not ceased in the way that those of us who, well, has not ceased in the way that, frankly, I anticipated with the election of Obama. Because, again, you know, we have a real problem, a systemic problem in this country with the plutocracy. And know, I'm not the only one who said this. Digby linked to a couple of reports. One is from J.P. Morgan, talking about profit margins, which have reached levels not seen in decades for corporations. The challenge, which we have discussed many times before, what is driving these margins? This is a J.P. Morgan analysis. One useful way to deconstruct profits is to measure them from peak to peak and analyze what changed. As shown in the first chart, S&P 500 profit margins increased by 1.3% from 2000 to 2007. There are a lot of moving parts in the margin equation. But as shown in the second chart, reductions in wages and benefits explain the majority of the net improvement in margins. In other words, these increase in profits that are coming for corporations have come completely at the expense, almost completely, at the expense of workers in terms of wages and in terms of benefits. And why do we see this? Why do we have CEOs and board of directors that believe they can continually shit upon their workers with impunity? And why are they interested in doing this? Because they are running cottage industries known as their own equities portfolios that are filled with stock options from their companies. And they know that their stock values go up when short-term profits go up or mid-term profits go up, where they cut workers, they cut expenses. And then she quotes U.S. labor compensation is now at a 50-year low relative to both company sales and U.S. GDP. Class war, folks. This is class war. And Citigroup last summer, or I guess a couple of years ago, the world is dividing into two blocks, the plutonomy and the rest. Economies that are powered by the wealthy. Plutonomies, where economic growth is powered by and largely consumed by the wealthy few, and the rest. Two types of economies in this world, plutonomies and the rest. And what we have in this country is not only a plutonomy, an economy driven by the wealthiest 5%, 20%, 1%. We also have, sadly, a plutocracy, where that money has bought them the lion's share of political power. And so watching these protesters march up to these people's homes, frankly, I enjoy, because this power is not coming back to the people unless they take it. Nobody gives up power. Nobody gives up power without a fight. Let's go back to the phones. You're calling from a 604 area code. Are you there?
Hey, Sammers, this is SJ.
Sunshine Jim, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, pretty good. You got a lot of lag on that phone line occasionally, but I think we're connected pretty good. How do we sound?
Yeah, you sound great. I think you sound pretty good to me.
Hey, they were worried about fragrance in the middle of New York City, right?
Yeah, they're worried about hygiene and, you know, apparently the only place where anybody does... You know, look, are there drugs down at Zuccotti Park? Probably a little bit.
Let's hope so.
Security.
Hey, you know, it's a great media opportunity for a personal fragrance group to get good PR and branding. Maybe you should do a Majority Report cinnamon spice protest fragrance.
Maybe.
Hey, Sammer, would you give me a call sometime?
Sure. Well,
okay, I love you.
Sunshine, we can't have these personal conversations on the air, buddy. You're supposed to call in.
Well, we have him on the phone, too. Please call sometime and talk to me at length.
Okay, I'll try. I mean, you know, you know how busy I am, buddy. I don't talk to anybody on the phone.
Hey, this has been a great show. Wonderful information. Put it out. We've got people who have never listened before tuning in and finding out what's going on. And you've done a great job, and the interviews and conversations and phone calls have been great.
All right, I'll call you.
All right. See you later, Sam.
Sonny, thanks for calling. I appreciate the phone call. Yeah, for those people who are listening for the first time, I should tell you, one, we started late today. This is a very atypical show. Usually I am ensconced in my studio in New York City. But today we are in Las Vegas. I am down $50, and I'm at the Mass Tord Conference. Tomorrow on the program, Cliff Schechter will be joining me live out of studio, but he will be with me as we are both out of studio. And Fridays are always fun. Let's go back to the phones. I don't know. I think you're calling on Skype. Who's this?
Hey, it's Tim Johnson from Bangkok.
Tim.
Diluvian, Bangkok.
Tim is calling from Bangkok, Thailand. Are you still in Bangkok? Because the last report I heard was that... Oh, you got to turn down your stop the stream, Tim. The last report I heard was that you were going to evacuate because of the flooding.
Yes. It's the worst flooding in 52 years. The airport is surrounded with massive earthworks, 11.5 feet high. All the northern part of Bangkok is already flooded. It's already started to rain. It's going to be about at least 3 feet of water around me. I've got the last flight out tomorrow to Phnom Penh. It's a panic in the capital of Bangkok, a city of 10 million people and a million visitors.
So, Tim, why is there flooding? I mean, I understand Bangkok, you know, for people who aren't familiar with Bangkok, there's quite a bit of water that runs through the city, right? I mean, there's there are channels and a big river. Is that right?
Yes. It's a climate change issue. The rains came late, and they stayed late, and the... autumnal tides are pushing salt water up the main river that goes through Bangkok, where there's a confluence of many, many, many rivers from north. On top of that, we have Toyota announced they're ceasing all operations in Thailand, as well as Honda. A massive plant is closed. There's 3 meters of water, so 9 feet of water in some of the provinces, just 100 kilometers north of Bangkok.
Wow. Wow. So this isn't going to be one of those things where people's basements floods. This could be... This is why there's such panic, right? Because people just can't get out.
The people can't afford to get out. I got a flight. The airport is the major asset. They have, like I said, these earthworks, 3.5 meters high. They have grass on them. The airport is sort of like a bathtub in the middle of a lake. Around the airport, it's completely flooded. But the airport itself has pumps and these earthworks, and it's... down in, we feel that probably the most downtown section won't flood because there's enough clogs and canals to absorb the water. They're building canals all around the city in massive effort. Water is difficult to find. Right now it's flooding right in front of me. The rain is coming. The sewers are coming. The water's coming up where I go because it's confluence of three things: water from the north, the tidal change from the Oh, Thailand, the full moon tonight. And right now I have, there's a deluge coming out right now. 17 centimeters of water will mean about a meter of water in Bennington.
Wow. All right, Tim. Well, stay safe. You know, touch base with us when you're able to get out of there so that we know that you're safe. And thanks for updating us. I mean, there's just such little news on this. It's stunning, and it sounds like it could be a huge, huge humanitarian crisis.
Okay, good night, Sam.
All right, good luck. Stay safe. Tim Johnson, our buddy Tim Johnson calling from Bangkok. I got a little more time, folks, to take some more calls. 646-257-3920. I'm going to go a little late today because I've missed being live. Jay Shivon, please stop gambling. You are indirectly risking losing listener money. Joe Cassano, you're not. Occupy Las Vegas. No more bailouts. You know, we were in touch with the Occupy Vegas people. In fact, they're not going to be here, I think, until Saturday, when we will be gone by that point. No, I will not lose much money. But, you know, the way I... Oh, and if somebody knows how to play craps, email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Maybe you can give me some tips on the show tomorrow. Because that's what... my plan is this. And it's not, you know, terribly different from the banking industry. My plan is to leverage $1 and make 33. And I'd like to do it at craps. Basically, what I'd like to do is to come back from Vegas. I want to win anywhere between $5,000 and $50,000. So if you know how to do that at craps, let me know, please. And of course, I don't really have much of a stake to start off with. So you got to give me, you have to be clever about it. But the idea is I'm going to make a ton of money here in Vegas, and then we're going to use it to buy swag. The missing link. Harmonizing with the Republican agenda, Fox News and Fox Business have launched a full-scale attack on the Environmental Protection Agency, labeling the agency job terrorists who are strangling America. Send that to majorityreporters@gmail.com if you could. One thing that I've noticed is a trend, certainly happening in Boston, it's happening in some of the cities that want to deal with their Occupy protests by claiming that, like, this is drawing valuable police resources. And it's costing the city money at a time that we can't afford it. Now, of course, cutting police services, they have no problem with that. Lowering taxes, they have no problem with that. But Americans going out and practicing democracy, that's a problem. Well, here's my suggestion. If you got a problem and your city can't afford cops down at these protests, don't send cops down to the protests. Be a good example for everybody to understand what happens without taxes to pay for these things. I'm happy now. Hi, Sam. Will you try to get Michael Lewis on? Yes, I will. He wrote Boomerang, the Meltdown Tour, which tells the stories of the fiscal rescuiness both in Europe and U.S. He says, we're headed for a third world status. Terry Gross interviewed him. Very interesting. Glad you're live today. My hubby and I went to Occupy Reno. About 200 people. Another meeting this Saturday at 1. Exciting. Amateur Left would really love to see this move your money thing take off. Bank of America and other bad actors can't steal your money as easily if it's not in their vaults. That's right, folks. If you've got a local credit union, good place to do your banking. Cool J 146. Did you hear that Bloomberg wants to clean Zuccotti Park and disallow camping there starting tomorrow night? Apparently the same thing was done to clear out Bloombergville. No, I didn't hear that. I will try and get an update for tomorrow's program. 6815189. Love it when you bust out the class warfare talk. I don't know what to tell you, folks. I mean, there's no other answer. That's what's going on in this country. And it's, I got news for you. It's an asymmetrical war. And one side's not even waging it yet. And I say yet because there has got to be an inevitable backlash to this. And I think we're seeing it with Occupy Wall Street. Left Coast Marcus, hot coffee, brilliant doc, must see. All issues come down to the influence of money in politics. What is needed is not a redistribution of wealth, but an undoing of the redistribution of wealth that has been happening for the last 30 years. Well, there's only one way to do that, and that you have to redistribute the wealth down. I think that we need to have taxes that will essentially confiscate money. There is an unbalance because tax rates have been so low on the wealthy. We should abolish the capital gains tax and just treat all income as income. You want to put in some type of deductions for jobs created? Fine. Tax credits for jobs created? Fine. But this capital gain stuff is bullshit. And I think we've all learned that, right? And I know conservatives agree with me because I know how much they hate government to pick winners and losers. Bloomberg is going down tomorrow at 7 a.m. to clear the park. No more tarps or sleeping bags, apparently. Wow. They seem to have lost their patience. Interesting. I will do a little more research and find out what I can find out, and we'll have somebody on to talk about it tomorrow. This sucks. I wish I could be in New York to check this out. Wow. All right, folks. I will talk to you tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. And if I can figure out how to do this. Folks, you can be become a member of the Majority Report by going to majority.fm and joining up. I need your support to maintain, to continue the show. Can you find better reporting on Occupy Wall Street anywhere else? Maybe. No, I don't think so. Certainly, we were, I think we were the first podcast ever to cover it. Or live show, frankly. And I know, via an interview with Ring of Fire, we were the first mass media to give any coverage of it nationally. And so your support does a lot more than just give you an extra 50 minutes a day of content. And, of course, you can support the show by buying your crap through our Amazon link, going to justcoffee.coop, using your coupon code MAJORITY, save 10%. Donate your account.com. Oh, and folks, podcastawards.com. We got nominated for People's Choice in Politics and News. Go and vote. You can vote every day. I encourage you to do that. I'll remember to say that up front tomorrow. Have a great day.